That, of course, is the incomparable Beyoncé.
Queen of country.
The new queen of country doing her version of the classic Jolene. And that is the hook this week, as we get to the hook, as we do every week, telling you some interesting things about a new topic in music. And Beyoncé is the topic in music
that album's
this
huge.
Week.
Going to be number one this week.
I'm Charles Latibodier.
I'm Eric Colley.
And we are here to get to the hook, so let's do it. Cowboy Carter released last week, and will be number one. And it is an interesting listen, the entire album. I'm not saying that wasn't shade. I don't want the beehive thinking that wasn't
you
shade.
You are kicking the beehive.
At all. It's just when you listen to it, and the whole thing about Cowboy Carter has been, this is Beyoncé doing a country album. And there are parts of it you listen to where it definitely feels like her doing country. And then there are other parts that feel like, oh, this is a Beyoncé, just a Beyoncé record.
And sometimes you get a little bit of both in the same song.
It's exactly.
Like a Beyoncé song with a country tinge.
Actually, I had to go back and look, wait, is that a new track? I'm looking at the thing going, no, it's the same song.
It's almost its own genre. It's like Beyoncé's new version of country. But so she is jumping genres for at least one album. She is not the first person to do this.
Yes, there have been a lot of people, and that is the hook this week.
Right.
People who have crossed over in the music business, whether it be for one album or whether it be just changing their career path altogether, who's done it well and who's probably wished they hadn't made the cross.
For some, it's a whole new career. For some, it's a fun one-off. For some, it almost ends their career.
Yes.
we're not going to be talking about, there's artists who... Their whole thing is genre mashing, like David Bowie and Prince and Beck.
Right.
And
that's not...
Miley Cyrus does everything. Gwen Stefani did everything. A quick special mention I wanted to point out, Linda Ronstadt.
Oh.
You don't always think of her as a top-of-mind kind of person like that. And I think most people remember her as like a pop rock singer in the 70s and 80s.
Yes.
But Linda Ronstadt won 11 Grammys and was nominated for 27. And some of the Grammy categories she won or was nominated for were pop, rock, country, Mexican-American, tropical Latin, traditional folk, best musical album for children. She also made a new wave album in 1980, did an album of standards with 50s band leader Nelson Riddle.
Yep.
Linda Ronstadt, just every album was a different genre exercise for her.
So you're saying Linda crossover queen Ronstadt.
Kind of. Honestly, that is fair to say.
Yeah. I don't know who's done that many different genres.
Every album was something different.
Right.
Somebody else who was really good at straddling genres, and since we played Jolene at the top here, Dolly Parton herself is a country artist.
Yes.
Certainly. She is a core country artist. Her most recent album was her first full-on rock album.
Mm-hmm.
She was also a pop crossover in the 70s and 80s, dabbled a little bit in disco, did a song written by Donna Summer, which actually was not the disco song.
I did not know that Dolly dabbled in disco.
A little bit. Everybody kind of did in the 70s. Everybody tried it. But so Dolly just did whatever she wanted to do. And that's kind of what I love about all these artists we're going to look at today, even the ones that it didn't work out. I love artists who just do whatever they want.
Right. I mean, there's a thing that in music we say, you should record what you want to hear, right? If you like it, then the goal, the hope is that, well, there'll be a lot of people out there who also like it.
Right.
And that, I think there's something to that. Like, that comes across in your performance, right? If you really like this, you're going to put your heart and soul into it, and that's really what your fans are looking for in your music. They want to hear your heart and soul in it.
Right. Well, that's why
it doesn't always work.
Obviously, I always say my favorite artist is Prince, and even when he veered into his Jehovah's Witness concept jazz record stuff, not always my favorite stuff.
What's the name of that album again?
The Rainbow Children.
The Rainbow Children.
And there's some cool music on that.
There are three or four tracks on that I really love, but you're right.
Even when he did something that I didn't love, I still like that. He's an artist, and that's just where his muse led him. That's what he wanted to do, so I always support that.
Yeah.
One of my other favorite acts is Blondie. Their four number one hits were a disco song, a guitar-heavy synth song, a reggae song, and the first rap song most of America ever heard.
Right.
They just did what they felt like doing, and I love that.
I was just listening to that yesterday,
Rapture,
because I was listening to it. It was a 1981 countdown.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Number one hit. So back to the country crossover here, Beyoncé... Not just the first artist to jump genres for an album, but certainly not the first to go into country. A lot of people seem to veer into country. Darius Rucker famously did.
Is it that they really love country, or is that it, you know that the country audience is so loyal that you want a piece of it?
I think it's a little bit of both. And I think that's why the country audience, they can be very open and embracing to artists who do this. They can also be very cynical and suspicious of, is this a cash grab? Is this because your career has faded somewhere else?
Right.
Sometimes it can be a bit of both. I always think, like, Darius Rucker, by the time he went country in the 2000s, Hootie and the Blowfish had kind of wound down as a big commercial band.
Right.
But honestly, his solo country stuff is not vastly different than Hootie's stuff.
Like, yeah, Hootie was already
they were
kind of
a bar band from South Carolina.
Kinda, yeah.
Yeah, like it wasn't like a wildly different sound for him. Jewel, Sheryl Crow, even Kid Rock, when they did country albums, they always kind of had a foot in country and folk and that kind of genre. Someone who made a bigger leap is one of the biggest country stars in the world right now, Jelly Roll, who's had a string of hits like Son of a Sinner and Need a Favor. He started out as a rapper. And this is a little bit of his song Creature featuring Tech N9ne, a very revered rapper.
Yeah.
But this is what Jelly Roll's rap album sounded like.
There's a monster under my bed, and at my window there's a dragon. I accepted the challenge, it turned me into a savage.
You can even still hear a little twang to it, though.
Right. So, I mean, is it really just the instrumentation that changes? I mean, he's singing more, obviously, now in country.
Well, he said that was part of the catalyst for him was going full country, is he didn't realize he could actually sing. Because, you know, he had a very troubled life. He was in prison, had a lot of addiction issues and stuff. And so rap is something that he really identified with, and he still loves it. But he didn't realize he had a very soulful voice. Nobody ever told him that. He didn't sing around people. And then once he discovered, hey, I can sing, then he just wanted to sing all the time.
And his career has, I'm correct, in his career is much bigger now.
Much, much bigger.
It was in rap.
And he is a great singer. So I think it was sincere, his rap thing. It wasn't like, oh, I tried this and failed and moved to that.
Right.
Just it evolved into that. Another act that went country, and this was weird circumstance. You remember the group Exile?
Yes.
Had the song Kiss You All Over. Mm-hmm. It was a huge number one hit in 1978. Pop, vaguely disco funk production, sort of. Exile had this number one song and then couldn't get past number 40 with any of their other singles. The lead singer left, had some health issues. New singers came in who were a bit more country-leaning. The band reinvented themselves completely as a country act in the 80s. Had 10 number one country songs. So here's a little bit where we're gonna go from Exile's Kiss You All Over into their 1983 song, Woke Up in Love.
I wanna kiss you all over. Over again. I woke up in love with you. Oh, what a beautiful day.
I wish you guys could see Charles' face.
I honestly would have thought always thought of Exile as just like one hit wonders. Like, I know that song. All right, that's good. And everyone's happy you got a hit.
That's a great song, too. I love Kiss You All Over.
I admittedly don't listen to as much country. I had no idea that they had 10.
They had a very, very, like, they were a huge country act throughout the 80s. I mean, they weren't like Alabama big, but they were cranking out number one hits.
Wow.
Yeah, they had a much bigger career, but in
so
most people's minds,
get rid of your singer and be like, hey, let's bring in someone for another genre and let's do that.
Yeah, and it worked both ways. So pop audiences remember them for Kiss You All Over, don't even know they were country stars.
Right.
Country fans kind of forgot about Kiss You All Over,
right.
Didn't know it. So they've got two separate careers, basically. One of the biggest country stars of all time started out in a psychedelic rock group, Kenny Rogers.
I love it.
Is in 1968 had a top 10 hit called Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In. What a great song title. Sounds like this.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, what condition my condition was in.
I can see all the colors.
Yeah.
I see all the colors.
My mind's expanding, man. Yeah, that is such late 60s. Psychedelic, weird, pop rock kind of stuff. Then the first edition had a hit called Ruby Don't Take Your Love to Town, which was a little bit more country-leaning. And then once the group split up, Kenny Rogers actually was rough for him in the 70s. There was a period where he was hawking commercials for guitar lessons and wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
Then he went solo, dug into country, and became one of the biggest country artists of all time and a crossover country act, too. He had two number one pop hits, and interestingly, both of his number one pop hits were written by acts who know a thing or two about genre hopping. Lady was written by Lionel Richie.
Yep.
Who did his own country album, Tuskegee, in 2012. His song, Stuck on You, you know that song.
Oh, yeah.
It was a hit on the pop chart, the R&B chart, the adult contemporary chart, and the country chart.
And all Lionel has always said that country is at his heart, just from growing up
right.
in Alabama. So
he loves country, and country loves him.
Yeah. In fact, I guess he's really made the same statement that Beyonce made about making her album, that he grew up listening to country. It was always around, and so it was an easy move for him. And like you said, it always went back and forth. Lionel
right. And could weave in little bits of all of it into each song.
But yeah, his connection with Kenny Rogers is what propels Kenny into
like superstar status,
right?
Like beyond just having some hits. You know, Kenny's other number one hit, "Islands in the Stream," with Dolly Parton, written by the Bee Gees.
Bee Gees, right?
And the Bee Gees, I think people probably don't always think of them as somebody who swapped genres or changed out, because you think, oh, the disco guys,
right? Well, it's because their disco era was so huge that you may not even know that there was a Bee Gees before.
And they were very successful before.
Yeah.
The Bee Gees came out, they were sort of compared to the Beatles a lot in the 60s, the harmonies, and they did that sort of, you know, mellow rock kind of stuff. Their song, "How Can You Mend a Broken Heart," was a huge number one hit in 1971. And then the hits dried up for the Bee Gees. As the 70s wore on, music got a little funkier. They just seemed like yesterday's heroes. And I love, one of my favorite strategies in rock, and I love this whole story, the Bee Gees moved to Miami. They're like, we need a fresh start, we need a new perspective. They loved what was happening in the clubs around them and all the, you know, the Miami music scene right. in the mid-70s. So in 75, they make this album, and they adopt R&B and funk and disco and all this stuff they loved. And they record this album and have this song they want to put out. They're like, this is a great song, but no one's going to play it because we are the has-been Bee Gees.
Right.
So they sent, this is back when you had to actually send actual physical records out to radio stations. They sent the song but did not put an artist on the label. So stations play this song. They love the song, and they start playing it, and like, they're calling the record label like, who is this? We don't know the name of the band. And they're like, ha-ha, suckers, it's the Bee Gees. We tricked you. And this is the song the Bee Gees sent out. Jive Talkin' is such a great song.
You can't...
Number one hit.
The arrangement, the instrumentation on that song is... Forget the disco thing. Like,
yeah.
Don't be hung up on that.
No.
You actually listen to the music. It's incredible.
Incredible song. That kicked off the whole back half of the 70s, their career, where they were just firing off number one hits. And then, of course, the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack and Stayin' Alive and Night Fever and all that. Because they tricked record labels into playing them. This new style they'd adopted, because they're like, no one's going to give us a chance.
And everyone forgets about the first wave of the Bee Gees. It's funny, I think if you listen to, like, if someone picks up a Bee Gees greatest hits, or you do a, if you just stream, go on and you'll find a Bee Gees
yeah.
compilation, you start listening, you're like, wait, what is that? That doesn't sound like, I mean, but it sounds like them, but it's a completely different sound.
Right. And some of those songs I think people do know, like To Love Somebody and I Started a Joke. Those are great classic songs.
What's the one that they did, the Massachusetts...
The Night the Lights Went Out in Massachusetts.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah. That's a perfect, beautiful song.
Yeah.
But it's just so very different than, you know, all the disco stuff.
There is a crossover that that worked out very well.
Yeah, it changed their whole career. Somebody else, you were like, I don't even know this person had another career first. Michael Bolton.
I had always heard about Michael Bolton's rock era. I've never heard a single, like,
well, he was a rock, he wanted to be a hard rock guy. In the late 70s, he had a group called Blackjack, had a song called Love Me Tonight that did okay. The guitar player for that group was Bruce Kulick, who would go on to join Kiss.
Yes, and I know that Michael Bolton and Paul Stanley are like best friends.
They wrote Kiss's song Forever. Michael co-wrote that. And then after that group broke up, Michael Bolton did a solo album, and he had a song called Fool's Game in 1983, and listen to it. So he wanted to be this, like, rock guy.
Yeah.
And... He did okay with it.
Right.
Like, his songs charted and stuff, not super high. But at that same time, do you remember Laura Branigan, the singer who did the song Gloria?
Sure.
He wrote a song for her called How Am I Supposed to Live Without You? Which he would eventually go on to remake his own song and have a number one hit with it. But that song was a hit for her, and he made a lot of money. And then he started writing some songs for Cher.
Wait a second.
And then he was like, oh. So then he's like, if I can just dial into these middle-aged white ladies... And he did all these covers of, like, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay and stuff, and just became the Michael Bolton we know.
A man loves a woman.
I wish he had gone back to his hard rock stuff, though. Imagine, like, in the 90s, he does, like, a heavy grunge record.
Maybe. I'm sure the checks were too fat at that point. It's like, why would I?
Why would you mess with that?
I'm not going to mess with the formula.
So, like, those were people who, they had whole career shifts.
Yeah.
The fun thing we want to talk about are the people who did one-offs, where they're, like, established stars, and they were like, I'm going to try this other thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was really cool. Sometimes it almost ended their careers.
Yeah.
And the most obvious one we got to talk about famously, and one of the most famous successful people in the world, Garth Brooks.
Has a blip on his career that he probably wants to forget, although it was so epically bad.
And it derailed his country career for a while. People were like, oh, Garth isn't cool anymore. The end of the 90s. Because it wasn't just doing, if he had done a rock or a pop album, okay.
Sure.
But he, you know, he committed to it, and it was a disaster, but I admire his conviction in this. And
he didn't just change a genre, he changed identity.
He changed identity. He took a huge swing as Chris Gaines, and the album was called Garth Brooks in the Life of Chris Gaines, who was this fictional Australian pop and rock star. He had a whole backstory for him that he had a near-fatal car crash in 1992, and he had this little soul patch and this black emo wig kind of thing he wore. And the first song he released from it was co-written by Babyface. This is Lost in You by Chris Gaines, a.k.a. Garth Brooks.
I'm head over heels at a show. I've played every field, I suppose. But there's something about
and you. Weird fun fact. Technically, on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, that is Garth Brooks' only top 10 hit and his highest charting song by far.
What?
None of his 90s country hits.
None of them?
No. Friends in Low Places never made the top 40 of the pop charts, because that's just how the charts worked then. So by a weird quirk of how the charts worked in the 90s, that song hit number 5.
Here's my thing about Chris Gaines. Was it a Garth idea and he went into the board and said, all right, here's what we're going to do? Or did someone come to him with a marketing idea? I mean, he must have had the idea for the song.
It wasn't just a song, because remember, there was supposed to be a movie called The Lamb, and he was going to do this whole biopic as Chris Gaines. I mean, he's so committed to it. In 1999, he hosted Saturday Night Live for the second time, and he was himself as the host, but as the musical guest.
It was Chris Gaines.
It was Chris Gaines with the wig, and people were just like, what are you doing? Who is Chris Gaines, and why are you... Like cosplaying here.
Exactly, bad cosplay.
Yeah. The album flopped. It was so rejected that the whole movie idea was completely scrapped, and it took him a couple years to live that down and kind of dust himself off and come back as Garth.
So the best way to look at that, if you're Garth Brooks or any artist who takes a big swing like that, is they just love you so much for what you've already accomplished. They just can't see you in this other role.
Right. And I
feel not a bad thing.
But it sucks that when you do, because Garth always loved... He loved rock. He was on the Kiss tribute album. He loved Kiss. He wanted to do other stuff. And when he tried it, the fans were like, nope. So he had to go back and do what they wanted. But I felt bad for
him. I don't feel too bad for him.
He's still Garth Brooks.
He's Garth Brooks. Like, yeah. I mean, but that things worked out.
That was a massive public humiliation. Another one that could have been, but was a secret. Do you remember Mariah Carey's mid-90s alt-rock emo punk album?
I do not.
Of course you don't. Nobody knew about it until 2020.
Okay,
that's a
well-kept secret.
It was a very well-kept secret, and she teased it, and nobody knew it at the time. So in 1995, right before Mariah's Daydream album comes out, that's the one with Fantasy,
sure.
One Sweet Day, Always Be My Baby, I remember seeing her doing an interview before Fantasy came out, and they're like, oh, Mariah, you know, are you working on new music? When's it coming out? And she's like, oh, yeah, it's going to be like an alternative grunge album. And she laughed, and it's like, can you imagine Mariah Carey doing that?
Right, and everyone probably thought it was a joke.
She actually did. So, but the thing is, when you hear it, you wouldn't have known it was her because it's not her voice. So she had recorded this album.
Say what?
The album's called Someone's Ugly Daughter by a group called Chick. And Chick was Mariah Carey. She co-wrote every song on the album except for one cover, and she sang it. But Sony, her label, was like, you absolutely cannot put this out with your voice on it. They would agree to let it be released, but they wouldn't let her voice be on it. So she got a friend named Clarissa Dane, who came in and sang it. It was this white woman who was in the video also. So she sings the lead vocals. Mariah did all the backing vocals. This was the single from it called Malibu. Yeah, so that was her, and it's a really aggressive, angry album because she and Tommy Mottola, her husband, who was also the head of her label and her boss, their marriage was kind of falling apart. So she was working out her frustrations in these songs, and he never knew it. And Mariah, like, her name appears nowhere on the album. So it came out in September of 95, did nothing. Because also the label didn't really want to push it too hard because people might figure it out. So Mariah kind of joked about doing a rock album. And do you remember her record label Crave in the 90s?
Yeah.
It was like her vanity label. Mm-hmm. In an interview, somebody said, why is it called Crave? And she goes, oh, it's from a song I released that nobody knows about, and maybe one day I'll tell you. On the Chick album, there's a song that has the lyrics, I Crave You, I Crave You. That's what she did.
That's why she named her.
So nobody knew this for 25 years. And then in 2020, when she did her memoir, The Meaning of Mariah Carey, right. She revealed, yep, that was me. I wrote the album. I sang the backing vocals. There's some version of it out there somewhere with her lead vocals
exactly.
on it.
Exactly. The recording is out there.
I'm not sure she even has those masters, but she said nobody knew. Yeah. And what's so funny is after that book came out, so again, you know, this album's not available on streaming anywhere. It's lost to time. After the memoir came out, copies of the CD and cassette popped up on eBay for $800 because people now suddenly really wanted this album.
Right, and they probably... the people who even have it probably didn't know that it was Mariah.
Yeah, anybody who bought it at the time, and probably was not that many people, because I think the video got played for 1 week. A couple of rock stations maybe played that song a little bit, but it just faded away. People were sitting on a gold mine for 20 plus years and didn't know.
And you wouldn't really even, when you listen to that, her background vocal is so blended in with the music. Unless you knew,
you can hear it now because you know
it's Mariah, but you would have no reason to be thinking that's Mariah.
But if I heard that in 1995, I would never have even remotely thought. Like, imagine you find out 20 years from now Taylor Swift secretly released a death metal album, and we just didn't know.
Wait a second.
Did she? Maybe. So Chick, nothing really came of that, but it was her just getting her frustrations with her relationship out. That was good for her. Sometimes people try things, and it's just so hated. Do you remember Lil Wayne's rock album?
Yes.
Rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This was, 2010. Well, he started teasing it in 2008 and 2009. This is right after, Lollipop and Emily and all that. And people were waiting for the Carter Four. And they thought, oh, that's what's coming. And then Prom Queen comes out, and this is what they got. But not the Prom Queen, the Prom Queen. This client sitting outside of my door. She never know how. Yeah, no, people weren't loving that. It got savaged by critics, fans. It sold pretty well its first week because it was a Lil Wayne album.
Right.
Debuted at number 2. Prom Queen hit the top 20. But I think it's sort of telling that the one album that people liked from that, or the one song people liked from that album, was the song Drop the World with Eminem, which is the most obvious rap song on the record.
Right.
It's kind of like, remember when Drake
did
his...
What they like from him, yeah.
Plus, like when Drake did Honestly Nevermind, it was, remember his like Jersey Bounce kind of club album a couple years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And people kind of hated it, but the one song that actually got to number one was Jimmy Cook's, which was the rap song. It was like you had this whole album of like mild club dance music and then a Drake rap song at the end.
It always feels
that's
like,
what people like.
It always feels like the one song they're putting on there just to appease the label. Like, all right, there's going to be one song that you can release that it's fine.
Right.
But I'm going to do my vanity project anyway.
Yeah. And he did it. People didn't love it that much. It did all right. But, it's Drake. What does he care? Other rappers tried some stuff. Remember when Snoop Dogg went reggae?
Yeah, and the thing about it is he tried to convince us that this was like the new Snoop. This is what he's doing.
Changed his name.
On. Right. Snoop Lion.
Snoop Lion.
Full on with the accent. a fake accent.
Did that bother you? As someone of Jamaican descent?
It bothered me, except that he said that this was... The story he was telling was that he went to Jamaica and he just felt... The spirit and the culture and that he was adopting it now. And I was like, all right, if that really happened and this is his new thing, then okay, maybe.
And then it was a one-off.
When it was a one-off, you go like, all right, well, then that was...
But Snoop always has an out. He can just say, man, I was so high. And you're like, well, I believe that.
Except I say, hey, Snoop, that happens to a lot of people who go to Jamaica. They don't come back and record an album and suddenly they're a reggae artist.
He's like the white girls that come back with the cornrows from spring break. Like,
that's no, his version.
No, that's Snoop's version. I'm Snoop Lion now. Queen Latifah. We've mentioned on here before, we love Queen Latifah. 2004, after the movie Chicago, she sang a lot for that movie. And I think people a lot of people didn't realize what an incredible singer she really is.
Yeah, she's got jazz singer chops.
Right, so she did a jazz album called the Dana Owens album, which that's her real name, and it wasn't a rap record at all. She just sang because she can. She can really well. She
really can, man.
Another rapper who tried something different. This one's a bit more recent.
Mm-hmm.
Andre 3000. We waited almost 20 years for this record.
It is a gross understatement, Eric, to say that he tried something different, okay? if Andre 3000 said, I'm going to do a country album, I think that would have been better accepted than... Because people didn't know what to make of this.
Yeah, New Blue Sun. Let's just play a little bit of it. His new age jazz flute record.
It's almost like did he sit down with Yanni at some point? Him and Yanni were chatting. He's like, what do you think you could do with what is the instrument he's
flute? And I also love that song we played. The name of that song is I Swear I Really Wanted to Make a Rap Album, but this is literally the way the wind blew me this time. That's the name of the song. And a long title, long song. That song's like 12 minutes. And it charted for a week.
Number 90 charted?
Because of just the curiosity.
90? Right.
So it became technically the longest song ever to make the charts. Yeah, people waited. You know, Outkast is so beloved, still so beloved. And they kind of split up
loved, respected.
On top.
Yeah.
You know, and people have been wanting, you know, Big Boy did all his stuff. And it's like, Andre, when are you going to make an album? He finally released his debut album after 15 plus years. And it was that. And not what I expected, not really what I wanted.
It's not what you, like you said, not what you expect. Do you have to respect it a little bit that...
I 100% respect it.
That he didn't give in to the pressure of what everyone wanted. He's like, I've just been chilling, doing my own thing, and this is what appeals to me right now.
And I mean, the song said, this is the way the wind blew me this time. And the thing I love about Andre is he's so weird, and he is an artist in the real sense of the word, and that's what he wanted to do. And he's not making music for me. He's making it for himself. And if that makes
him
happy.
And doesn't have to at this point. So.
It doesn't have to. Doesn't need to do anything for anybody.
So you could say you don't have to like it, but you can respect that he did it.
Right. Right. It was definitely...
Well, that's where I land on.
One thing we know is he did not do it for commercial reasons. The next person...
Yeah, no, you can't say sellout.
Yeah, the next one we're talking about got all kinds of cries of sellout, and he had to defend himself. Chris Cornell. Lead singer of Soundgarden, Audioslave, one of the greatest voices in rock music.
A man could sing a phone book and
beautiful voice.
It would sound amazing.
All his octaves, his range was incredible. So he had his solo career and made a couple rock records. And then he came out with this album called Scream in 2009. And it was produced by Timbaland, who was super hot at that point.
Right.
This is a little bit of what their song Long Gone sounded like. Sounds like Apologize by One Republic, which Timbaland just did. And people were like, his fans, you know, and rock fans are like country fans. They're very protective. And
right.
They feel like you sold out. And he got called sellout so often. And he tried to say, and maybe he wanted to have a hit. He hadn't had a hit in a while. He said that's not exactly at all how this happened. His last album, Carry On, had a couple songs, and Timbaland was going to remix them just for some, you know, a remix EP or something. And he and Timbaland just hit it off and wound up making a whole new album together. So for him, it was just this sort of fun artistic exploration.
Yeah.
Something different than what I've always done. And I think he enjoyed doing it. People did not care for it. And I hate that he got so much hate for it because, I mean, maybe he wanted to have a hit. I couldn't begrudge him that if he did. But the man had done what he wanted for 20 years at that point.
Right. It wasn't like he said, I'm never performing those songs again. He just wanted to try something different. And the funny thing is now when if you're online and you're looking, like they always lift these vocals on Instagram, there are always these posts where they lift just the vocals. And most of the Chris Cornell ones that they lift are him covering like songs that weren't Soundgarden, that weren't, you know, rock songs.
Right. He did a beautiful version of Nothing Compares to You after Prince.
Oh my God.
It was beautiful. Because like you said, the man could sing the phone book.
Yeah.
And so when you hear just like those stems of just his voice, I almost think as much hate as that got, if a DJ came now and like did a remix album of his vocals with different kinds of songs, I think it'd be kind of cool. It's not going to be what his audience wants, but it would just show the range his voice really did have.
We applaud that crossover.
I do applaud that. Or, you know, also somebody else who did dipped a toe in other waters, Lady Gaga, when she and Tony Bennett did their Cheek to Cheek album.
I think she did more than dip a toe. Like, she had a
she
full
jumped
leg
into the deep
in
end.
Right.
Right.
I mean, because she, they were all about.
They made two albums.
Made two albums, went on tour together. And his last performance, right, was with her.
Oh, he brought her out on stage, and you know, because he had dementia and they were worried about him forgetting lyrics and stuff. But he knew her. When she came on stage, and I saw an interview, and she like kind of cried about it, that for just that little bit of time on stage together, like his brain just, he knew all the words, he knew her, he knew where he was and what he was doing, because that's what he loved. And I think that one was a very sincere thing. Like, it was a very successful record, debuted at number one, because that's just something she loved. Because Gaga, somebody else talk about, you know, she's got her dance pop lane that she's really good in, but she can do all kinds of stuff. And she likes to do all kinds of stuff. And she has
gets,
fans
she
that
gets
support
accepted,
that.
Yeah. And her fans accept her crossing over into whatever she wants to do, they're following.
Right.
Kind of like Beyonce.
Yeah. As long as it seems sincere. And, you know, Beyonce's teased her next album, the third part of Renaissance, the rumors are it'll be a rock record. And I'm sure it will be the Beyonce version of a rock record, but it'll still be something different and cool. The last one I want to talk about, though, is the most ridiculous of all these. It's more ridiculous than Chris Gaines, because I don't even know what the intent here was. Pat Boone. Pat Boone was, for y'all who don't know, was a pop singer in the late 50s. It was sort of the main rival of Elvis for a hot second there. I've always had my issue with Pat Boone because, you know, people complain about how Elvis, you know, benefited from the segregation of the 50s, that he was a white man who was able to have the success. But if you look at Elvis's early big hits, Hound Dog was the only one that was really a cover of a black artist. And Big Mama Thornton's original version was already 2 years old when Elvis did it. And yes, he benefited from segregation, and it would have been great if Elvis had been more of a crusader for the civil rights. That's just not who he was. Pat Boone was like a poacher.
Right. He would jump on things immediately.
His version of R&B records would come out within a week or two of the original, and usually would chart higher because he knew, Pat Boone.
That's my audience. Hey.
I'm squeaky, clean white guy.
A nice white guy, yeah.
Still alive, still kicking in his 90s now. But his career had ended by the early 60s, and in the late 90s, in 1997, he starts showing up at award shows in like a leather vest and a dog collar and fake tattoos. And he'd also been like this contemporary Christian singer for a long time. His daughter, Debbie Boone, did the song You Light Up My Life. So he released this album called In a Metal Mood, No More Mr. Nice Guy. And it was going to be his metal covers album. And even this, it's so bizarre.
Because, Metallica fans, you might want to plug your ears.
Yeah, just listen to this.
Exit lights, enter night, take my hand, we're off to never, never land.
Yeah, so he did this cover of Enter Sandman by Metallica, but he didn't do metal covers. He did the metal songs as
Pat Boone.
Well, no, even more, he went like
as Pat
big
Boone
band and swing, like even, that's even before Pat Boone. So he did covers of Metallica, Judas Priest, AC/DC, Ozzy Osbourne, Guns N' Roses. And you think,
I don't know who it's appealing to, because the metal fans aren't going to want to listen to that version of it. And the people who listen to classic Pat Boone don't want to hear those songs.
No, they thought he had sold out as a Christian by covering these things. But the funny thing is, I think the sheer ridiculousness of it and the curiosity of it paid off. Because that album charted at number 125, which doesn't sound that impressive, but it charted in 1997. It was his first album to chart since 1961.
All right, he's back in the game.
Took him 36
years. So he's at 125. He's like, we're back. Woo!
I'm back on top. Kind of, not really, but closer than I was.
But people are talking about me and I look weird in this leather stuff. But yeah, he's kind of comfortable.
And there's a generation now that remembers him just for that, who might not have known who he was at all.
The lasting image, like the last image of Pat Boone in pop culture is dressed like that.
Yeah. Wearing a dog
really
collar.
Weird for the clean-cut
Squeaky
Christian
clean
guy from the 60s.
Pat Boone, yeah. So, you know, sometimes it works.
Be careful what you cross over into, because it might be the,
might
the
be the last thing
image.
You do.
Right. Well, that was educational.
I don't know where we go from Pat Boone's metal album. I mean, honestly.
I don't know. I hope that the Beyonce, if it is a rock album, that...
Don't wear dog collars and leather vests, Beyonce. Although she'd look good if she did.
Oh, wait a second.
You know what? I take that back.
Yeah. We should get out of here now before this gets even weirder. That's going to do it for Get to the Hook. We will see you next week.